Welcome to Highway to Health. I'm Jeremy Quinby. How are you doing, my friends? Great to hear from so many of you last week. Happy to hear that you found that episode with Dr. Aaron helpful. It's an enormous amount of information to process right now, and I think we'll have to do this once in a while to get through this, help us kind of process these challenging thoughts and feelings and the science of it all, and hopefully develop some actionable solutions. I've got Serge Avery on the show today, longtime friend, history teacher from Brooklyn Tech in New York City, the largest public high school in the country. I'm so happy that he was willing to do this with me and share his experience and insight, both as an educator and a historian. He'll be up in just a minute. If this is your first time listening to the show, I want to welcome you. Highway to Health is a place for you to explore and create your own blueprint for health. Having worked in integrative health for more than 20 years, I'm acutely aware of how all aspects of our lives come to have an effect on our overall state of being. And it's my hope that through the content and conversations that you get here, you'll become more engaged and empowered, both personally and in your communities. Big thank you to the new supporters of the podcast. Your dollars are helping us build more resource and a whole community of health support. If you appreciate the quality of content that we deliver here ad-free, you can support the show right now for as little as $1 a month by going to patreon.com/highwaytohealth or click the support link in the show notes on the app that you're listening on and become a supporter today. And if you're a health professional or involved in a health improvement project, as we discuss here in today's conversation, teachers are certainly essential to our development and daily contributors to our well-being. Please connect with me on LinkedIn or through the contact page on our website, highway2.health, so that I'm aware of your work. I'd love to bring you into this community of health improvement influencers. So if you're a student, teacher, or parent like myself and feeling trepidation for the upcoming school year, you are not alone. Those of us who experienced the challenges of online learning this past spring are eager to find solutions and methods to keep our children on track in their development through this upcoming school year while navigating the multifaceted challenges of teaching and keeping our kids socialized in a healthy way through the pandemic. Considering the historical event that we find ourselves in the midst of, I could think of no one better than Mr. Serge Avery to help us sift through all of this. With more than two decades of teaching in New York City public schools and a couple of years in Hawaii, he brings a perspective that I hope will give insight into what we're experiencing together, how to proceed as educators, and what the other side might look like from a historical vantage point. We start out here talking about his archaeological background and the work that he did before becoming a teacher. Please enjoy my conversation with Serge Avery. I've been thinking about talking to you for a while just because, you know, I just left New York the last time I was there. I knew you guys had just gotten back. Like, what was the date you guys came to the mainland again back from Hawaii?
I returned from Hawaii actually about 1 year ago.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah. And started teaching in September of 2019 back at Brooklyn Tech, which I had left.
Yeah. Well, maybe I just was seeing pictures you were posting of Hawaii or something and was thinking...
Oh, you're correct that I visited in February.
Okay. That's why.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So you had been back for a year. How long were you guys over there for?
I was there teaching with my family for 2 years, but I had lived in Hawaii two times before that.
Right.
But this was the longest stint.
So why Hawaii? I don't think I've ever asked you about that. Weren't you there for some kind of schooling at some point?
It's a good question. Considering I never had Hawaii on my radar as a place I could wind up living or even necessarily visiting when I was in my 20s.
Right.
But I completed a master's degree in archaeology and had worked mainly in the Middle East as well as continental United States.
Where in the Middle East were you?
I worked in Israel and Jordan, as well as visited many of the surrounding countries. But I worked on archaeological projects, mainly in Israel and Jordan, and I got a master's degree in Middle Eastern archaeology.
Oh, wow. So what were the projects you were working on over there?
I was interested in the prehistory of the area, because once you get into the sort of early historical period, having to deal with so-called biblical archaeology, it becomes a very contentious subject matter. And I thought the period before the written word, it was a very sort of maybe a more objective way of approaching studies of land use and things like that.
So for those of us who don't have the scope, what is that time period?
I was working on projects from what was known as the Neolithic period, and I would say that's about 5,000 years before present, 5,000 years ago.
Okay.
To 6,000 years.
Yeah.
I mean, Middle Eastern archaeology is sort of fascinating. It's almost like a layers of an onion, and there are so many different groups that have occupied the area, and so many people going through that. It's actually an incredibly complex jigsaw puzzle. But I was interested in the period sort of right before what we would call state formation, sort of like the rise of ancient Egypt and the rise of Israel as a state.
Okay. And
sort of that transition from hunting and gathering to early agriculture.
Gotcha.
So that was, but you know, it's tough to get a job as an archaeologist. But you can work in what's called salvage archaeology in the United States, something most Americans don't know about. But federal and state laws require archaeological surveying and investigation before federal funds and state funds are used on building projects, especially like highway building.
Okay.
So I worked as also known as a contract archaeologist for years in parts of the United States. And I had a friend in 1993 working in Hawaii, and she got me a job, and I showed up there knowing very little about the place, but was completely blown away by the natural beauty of the land and the generosity of its people, especially Hawaiians. It has a very interesting immigration history tied into the last 100 years.
Oh, I can imagine.
And then I was jumping forward, I became a New York public school high school history teacher, and we are eligible for sabbatical, and as long as you study within your discipline anywhere in the United States, and I think no New York teacher had ever thought of studying in Hawaii, and the Department of Education certainly was not happy. They did not want me to go, but they could not find a way to turn me down. So that was in 2010 with my wife and young kids at the time. And then after 17 years in New York, we thought, let's change the pace. So that's what brought me there in 2017 to 2019.
And then you were back again for another couple
of years? Then, you know, I routinely have visited.
Okay.
I mean, I was visiting actually February of this year, okay, as coronavirus was just starting to go into the mainland.
And you guys may have, I think I was in New York like early March. I left on the 13th, I think.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing a post that you made like not that long after I was gone, saying your wife probably had it. I mean, they weren't, testing. Yes. Testing was really hard to get at that point.
Yeah. So yes, my wife, Rebecca, was in Hawaii herself teaching law school for a month, took a plane back on the 16th of March, and I'd say 48 hours later, came down with certainly what seemed like flu-like symptoms, even though she had a flu shot, and was really, you know, pretty sick. Luckily, not sick that had to get us to a hospital, and there was no way of testing at that point. There was no way to get a test in New York.
She had the cough and everything too?
She definitely had the cough and the fever. The only thing she did not have was the loss, really, of smell.
Okay.
But she might have.
Yeah.
But, you know, strangely, we all tested negative for antibodies. So who knows? Right. But I think she did have it.
At what point did you get the antibody test?
It would have been about 3 months after her. So,
and that's probably a little too long. I mean, they say 2 to 3 months, probably, you know, that range.
Correct.
So, So how did you guys manage the quarantine in your house?
Did
you guys keep space?
As you know, Jeremy, you know, New York City was really hit hard. And
space is at a premium in homes. So I was just trying to figure out how you guys managed that.
We are lucky that we have a duplex apartment with two teenage boys who, you know, sort of are at the age where they can do their thing in their section of the house.
Yeah.
Yet the first month of quarantine in New York, I would say it was a very harsh experience. The streets were empty except for the sounds of ambulance sirens.
And
there was a real fear, and more than a fear, there was death sort of around you. So certainly here in the neighborhood I live in, Brooklyn, neighbors died, as well as...
Did you have a coworker who died too, I think?
I had a 46-year-old coworker, history teacher who worked alongside me, who died very suddenly from a heart attack.
Oh, it wasn't coronavirus related? Or not
he,
sure?
We do not know at the time if he had it, but he did text some friends a few days before he passed away, saying he certainly felt like he had the symptoms of coronavirus. And most of us who know him and know the situation do think his death was the result of a coronavirus-related. And, you know, the woman who greeted me every day at the YMCA, she passed away. People who worked in bodegas near us passed away.
Yep.
And it hit, I think, the minority community of New York City very hard.
Yeah.
You know, we kept a positive attitude to the best we could and tried to stay safe. And we certainly limited our exposure to other people. And I would say, I think the biggest challenge, at least for my teenage sons, was they're at an age where they're so social.
Yeah.
And as someone who also teaches kids, teenagers of this, I just know their social needs are as strong as their need to drink and eat. You take it away from adults, it's hard. I think when you take it away from 15 through 18-year-old kids, it's extremely difficult.
Is that one of your biggest concerns? I mean, I'm sure there's, as you're now in the you know, prep stages for this next year. Oh, by the way, I think since I talked to you last, we found out that we are distance learning starting the year.
Oh, wow.
They made an announcement here yesterday in Minneapolis that basically they're kind of leaving it up to counties because, you know, in at least in Minnesota, you know, everything is pretty centralized in terms of density around Minneapolis and a little bit around Duluth. And so that's other than that, you know, the cases are much lower in those other counties, so they can probably manage if they're sort of smart about distancing in schools. And, you know, there may be certain activities where they want them to be masked, or, you know, I'm sure there'll be a lot of hand sanitizer. But in Minneapolis, the cases are still just high enough. They created a threshold of 50 per 1,000 people, I think, is what they wanted to have it be below to start in class. And I think Minneapolis was at like 51 per 1,000.
Wow.
So it's like very close.
Wow.
And so it's low, you know, compared to sort of the Sun Belt and some of these places that are getting hit hard right now. But where's New York at this point? I got some texts yesterday from people saying things have really, you know, opened up a little bit more.
I don't have that statistic for you, but I'm pretty sure we're hovering at a 1% or less infection rate.
Mm-hmm.
And the discussion here with the mayor and the chancellor is that we are going to open and what they're calling a hybrid model of students, probably 60 to 70% of their learning will still be done online, but then trying to come in a few days a week to their physical schools in these sort of pods of small numbers and along with masks and social distancing. I think there's a lot of skepticism from teachers and others that it could be, that it will work well and keep people healthy. At the same time, I think the need for, you know, if you ask my sons and most of their friends, do you guys want to go back, even if it's 1 or 2 days a week, and you're going to be wearing masks and you're not really going to be hanging out in the lunchroom with your buddies, they all say yes.
Okay.
So most say yes.
Yeah, I'm sort of dealing with the same situation here with Phoenix. It's like, you know, but he also knows of, you know, all the mistakes that people are making. And I think here,
yes.
I think in New York, you had a serious wave where, you know, once you see it and once it's sort of obvious, because you know people who are dying from it. I mean, we, in our family, my wife's aunt just passed on Tuesday.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah. And it was, you know, probably she waited a little bit too long to go in. You know, she was older. She was close to 70. And, but no major pre-existing conditions. So, you know, a little bit of vascular health stuff, but nothing major. Yeah. So, you know, that helped Phoenix to, you know, take it seriously and also realize that, you know, we've sort of brought my mom into our family quarantine. So he knows that. I just told him kind of early on, if, you know, if he makes any mistakes, because it's bound to happen, to just let us know. Because then we know, like, grandma can't come over for a little bit. You know, we got to see how things play out.
Yeah, so we're in the same boat here in a way, you know, and I think it's very easy to let your guard down, especially, I mean, I have, you know, adults do. Our social needs are so strong that I find it's pretty amazing that you can tell yourself, well, this feels safe, when you sort of know it probably isn't. Right. But as you said, 25,000 New Yorkers died relatively quickly.
Yeah.
And so I do think even amongst young people here, there is a severity to the situation that they comprehend. And as if I were to generalize, they take it seriously and want to stay safe.
Are there
most
teachers?
Most people know someone who died.
Yeah, yeah. Are there teachers who are not going to come back because they feel like the risk is too high for them? That you know?
There are. So there's a process here. You know, New York City teachers are part of a strong union, and there's a process here to apply for certain medical exemptions that, if medically documented, should be granted with underlying health conditions as well as age. Again, I'm on a chat with, you know, I work in actually the largest high school, public high school in America right now. We have 6,200 students,
oh, wow.
300 teachers. So it's a massive place.
I didn't realize Brooklyn Tech was that big.
In my 17 years there, when I arrived, it was about 3,500.
Is that right?
And now we are not double, but close to double.
Wow.
And we're really at capacity. So to be honest, it's really a challenge to figure out how to bring in 6,200 students and 300 adults, plus that doesn't even count support staff. So almost 7,000 people.
Yeah.
In a safe way, in a staggered, clearly you're not going to have 7,000 in the building. I do feel for the administration of my school, because they've been sort of left with the job of trying to figure out how to make this safe. And they're not epidemiologists or public health officials.
I know. Yeah. And you know, I've been trying to. I just did a podcast this past week about really kind of, you know, dealing with some of the myth busting around what's going on with the virus, because it's very hard.
Yeah.
Just like anything else, once you hear something to disprove that data, or just, you know, the some of the ideas that people have, and some of it seems crazy. And I think if we understand what that looks like, and, you know, what that distance looks like, how things can move, how masks, you know, help, and just so that it's demystified a little bit, it's not that hard to manage. I feel like we could be doing a much better job if we weren't caught up in some of the politicking around it. And
yes.
I think that's why we've gotten to the point where we are right now.
Yes. I mean, even if you put the politics aside, the uncertainty the medical science on this seems to change day by day. So yeah, for exactly. example, the new study showing that actually now it seems kids are can be pretty contagious. And I think for teachers, this is the one thing we've been told, don't worry, kids don't catch it. You won't catch it from them. And there's just seems to be real uncertainty behind the studies on this. So I think there's the confusion and uncertainty is what makes it really unsettling.
Yeah. And I don't think the layperson can necessarily process this much information day after day after day. We're almost 6 months in here.
Yeah.
And it's just when the information keeps changing constantly, it's hard to stick with it. And we just, end up like at a certain point, I think the sort of back to what you were talking about your boys, like there are just some sort of essential needs that
yes.
if they're not getting met, we'll take some risks. And, yeah. My question is, can we figure out how to manage those risks even more? Like, could we give each other hugs if we both had masks on, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Like there are things that we're going to, some mistakes that we're going to make, but everybody's going to be risk managing here to some extent
yeah.
until this is finally gone. And, I just sort of assume that we're in this for another year or so. And I think if you think about it from that standpoint, then it's just a matter of like, we're just going to manage this until the numbers go down to the point where it's no longer a real issue anymore. And there may be a herd immunity part of that, but it also may be one of those things that, we just have better testing for to know what's happening like right on the spot, faster tests,
Yes.
And then, let's hope there's some kind of vaccine. But I still think that there'll be holes in the vaccine as soon as that comes out too. Not that it's not worth it to take. I just think that it's never going to be perfect. I mean, none of the flu vaccines are.
As a history teacher, I teach how change impacts society, right? And
yeah.
I feel that's actually one of my biggest goals as a teacher of history is to sort of get kids to sort of see these examples from the past about how quickly the known world can change. And I do think COVID-19 is one of these sort of world-shattering events.
Mm-hmm.
And how we come out of it is still out there in the open as to, some countries I think are going to come out of it better than others.
Mm-hmm.
It's too early to tell how we're going to do. But I think history, the study of history really shows you that the ability of people to adapt to change is this vital ingredient to the survival of our species. And so we're actually living through one of these moments, which is sort of rare over the grand sweep of history.
Isn't there something about human yeah. behavior that's always kind of built into history too, that it seems like you can't help but study if you're in it?
Yes. I actually think historians study texts, basically. That's what they do.
Yeah.
And social scientists, anthropologists, sociologists, psychologists, are studying human behavior. Sometimes the two don't meet enough. But it's, I think this pandemic is causing us to think a lot about human behavior. So historians study, for example, the human behavior that occurred during the Black Death to the best of their ability,
right,
based on texts and archaeology, or the human behavior that happened during the Spanish flu, as well as what governments do and what leadership does, all very important.
Right.
So there's been a lot of historians trying to mine the past to see the response of humans to pandemics. I mean, it was actually interesting if you went on Amazon to look at how many books have been written about how pandemics have shaped history. I think you'd be surprised how many.
Is that right?
There are. Yeah, it's actually a sort of ripe field of historical inquiry. There's been a lot of studies on the impact of plagues and people, with a good dozen titles written by some very qualified historians. So, for example, the Black Death, one of the things historians notice, there's this opening that allows society to be recreated in a slightly more equitable way, because actually wipes out anywhere between 30 and 70% of Europe. The labor force is decimated. All of a sudden, labor is worth more.
Oh, yeah.
So the aristocracy has to figure out how to pay labor more, how to And as a result, the working class seemed to move up in society somewhat. I mean, this is like slightly positive take on when historians look at some of the changes that came out of these things. Like, so the Italian Renaissance, or the Renaissance in Florence, they say really the plague has a lot to do with what happens there. But I'm not an expert.
And probably any war, any major war that's gone on has some of the same qualities, right? I mean, early in the pandemic, people were sort of referring to this as like this invisible war, and which, you know, it's not that far from the truth when you think about, you know, what a place goes through. I mean, certainly in Minneapolis, we've had some times are changing, you know, quickly by the day. I mean, the crime rate in July has just skyrocketed, and I think a lot of it has to do with the impacts of people who really just didn't have access to some of these, you know, programs that are all of a sudden, you know, that stuff is really kicking things into gear on top of the protests and the people who have, you know, lost work from the pandemic and, you know, from some of these neighborhoods that were decimated during the protests here too. So I actually had a friend whose wife was had a gun put to her head at noon on Tuesday here. At a paint store, coming out with no cash or anything on her, just going in something that she had already ordered online, you know. So, I mean, that's unheard of. It's really like, you know, it's about a half block from where my office used to be. Not, you know, technically a neighborhood that you would be concerned about going into at any point until recently. Yeah. So, you know, there are some things that are shifting very quickly there. And I've heard even in New York, I don't know, I'm sure you're probably spending most of your time in Brooklyn at this point, but I've heard there's been quite a few problems in the city too.
There's certainly been a spike in crime. I do think that's probably like a complicated avenue to then maybe discuss with, you know, in the context of police reform, police reform demands, and whether the police are, how they're policing right now and what's going on. So, but, you know, but one thing, I'll go back to history. In the Black Death, many of the writers of the time talk about a sort of free-for-all feel to society. There's talk of increased, you know, sort of, there is lots of irregular sexual activity during this time as people are thinking the world's coming to an end with death all around them, all sorts of things. They retreated into all sorts of occult practices. And so again, these events really, I think, expose all these vulnerabilities and belief systems. And the historians will have a lot to study on this one.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure.
And you know, I'm just hearing more and more. I mean, because what you're talking about is basically, you know, mental health challenges.
Yeah.
You know, the ability to process your current reality, and if you have, you know, a challenge in your past, you know, any sort of trauma or anything, this is such a triggering period, and it just makes it harder and harder to process. And I treat a fair amount of trauma and stuff, and so a lot of the therapists, you know, both the therapists I treat who are overwhelmed and some of the people that they're working with end up coming in to see me at times like this, because it's just, you know, you have to like figure out ways to, you know, sometimes my role is really to kind of create space for people to decompress more than anything, because it's very challenging, you know, especially when you're sort of on your own or, you know, not having these, you know, very important in-person conversations, or just, you know, being able to have physical contact with another person. That's one of the ways we process. So, you know, I'm thinking, you know, back to your boys again, I'm thinking a lot about this as my, you know, I feel like daily I tend to have a lot of empathy in general. So I struggle with what my kids are probably experiencing right now and how it's going to affect them. And so, you know, I'm sure. And so,
and I think it's not being discussed yet in the way it should be.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe you know more about this than I do, and like mental health field, you know, figuring out how this, what you should be doing as these things develop. But I, as someone who just spent 3 months teaching 170 kids online, I realized the mental health needs of my students. I had no idea what was going on, but I knew it wasn't great, especially when I got emails in the middle of the night that such and such's parent was taken to the hospital.
Yeah.
These were these heartbreaking emails that I received. The guidance staff in public schools and school psychologists, God bless them, they do very hard work, but they're stretched very thin.
Yeah.
And so, again, 6,000 students, maybe 2 social workers, 1 psychologist. And teenagers don't just tell their teachers or their parents what's going on.
Yeah.
So I think we're going to be, there's going to be a reckoning with this for a while.
Yeah.
With young people.
Yeah. And I think maybe that's one of the things, I mean, one thing that I'm hearing in Minneapolis, as far as the school system is concerned, is there's a few different, you know, pieces to this. I mean, you have some kids in school whose, you know, parents are essential workers. You know, they're either in healthcare or they're in jobs that have not closed down because they're essential services. And that's a very, you know, difficult thing to deal with. And here there were a few schools that allowed some of those essential workers in, like, they had them kind of all in, you know, like one school I know here, so that they could sort of keep them somewhat on track with their studies, but also just have a place for them to be able to go every day. And they kept them in small groups within the schools.
Yes.
I don't know. Is that, did they do something like that for you guys or?
So the real idea here of reopening in the fall is to meet some of those needs of certainly students who, you know, many are living with 3 siblings in a 1-bedroom apartment. And the idea is to create some spaces. Right now in New York City, parents have the option of saying, I'm going to keep my kid home. They can receive instruction 100% of the time.
Yeah.
So every parent has the option here. And I believe that's probably in many school districts right now. But I think there was this real acknowledgement that maybe we lost a third to 40% of students who just didn't check in. And then you start to realize how important schools are and the social services they provide.
Oh, I know.
Social.
And food.
Yes, exactly. Food, structure, support, encouragement. It means a lot. And I can tell you, I think I could speak for a lot of teachers. Certainly teaching them via, you know, online is just not the same as the presence. I mean, it goes back to sort of some of these things you're talking about with our social needs, like being in a room together means something.
Yeah.
Kids I had who were so social in a class just stopped talking online in like a Zoom class. They just shut down. And I sort of get it. I didn't really feel like talking much over a computer every day. You can do it to supplement, but it was the idea that all of a sudden this was our new world. But it was better than nothing.
Yeah, absolutely. But there's so much lost in that. So my daughter is going to start 4th grade this year. And sort of just, you know, 3rd grade is just not quite old enough to have that real sort of self-motivating piece. And I think there's just something about, I mean, it was just such a battle to get the school work started. They would do like a check-in every morning. And then after that, we would do schoolwork. But she was kind of exhausted by the Zoom call. So she wanted a break, which is understandable.
Sure. Yeah.
But then to try to get things rolling again at some point in the day after that is like almost impossible. You know, I give her like half hour and say, okay, I'm going to, sometimes I just set an alarm on like Alexa or something. Just so like there was like a structure to it where there was a tone and that meant we're back on the kind of like the school bell, you know?
Yeah.
Because otherwise it's like really hard to, you know, to come up with strategies for you, you know, with your kids. But when they're in school together, they're just doing what everybody else is doing. You're sort of in it together, even if, you know, most kids complain about school at this age. So
Correct.
But to have that, it's just the presence of those people around you that kind of keep that energy is really what kind of keeps you in it.
Yes. I mean, and as you're talking about your young daughter, I'm thinking we all know these stages of development in children. Yeah. And, they become, society sort of makes them technological beings where they become connected with screens. They don't come out of the womb that way. And I think it's so joyful to see little kids interacting. It's so important. I think elementary schools should be having a serious discussion about how to stay open, as does, I guess, the American Academy of Pediatrics. So teenagers, they're different, but it pains me to think of your young daughter trying to get through a day on a laptop.
Right. I mean, and luckily, I mean, unfortunately, my practice was, closed down in the spring, so I was able to be present. With unemployment ending, I'm probably going to end up, working a very small schedule so that I can be present for this. And, when you're at home all day long, you have to cook a couple of meals for everybody. So, keeping enough food in the house with a teenager as well. I'm at the store two or three times a week, just filling up the cart.
Same here.
There's something that's been very nice about that, too, just to be able to have that, all the time.
Yes.
But it's a lot to focus on, and sometimes I'm exhausted and can't focus on, all the needs of the kids either. But it's a very different situation between Phoenix, who's starting his senior year of high school, and her in terms of development. Like, I'm concerned about him, on some level, in the same way with your boys, he's lonely a lot of times, and that's hard to see. But, he can kind of express that in a way where I think she's going through things sometimes, but doesn't have the history to, sort of compare it to anything else. And so,
that's right.
We're taking advantage of the summer as much as we can, and being outside and going for bike rides with her friends. And last night we had pizza outside with one of her friends and parents and stuff. So,
We've been doing the same here in New York.
Some of that can happen, but my concern is for the cooler weather. What are we going to do? I mean, I've been thinking about, do we get some really just badass, winter stuff so that we can spend time outside seeing the kids that way? That might be what we have to do this year to keep some of the, that contact to have them see each other face to face.
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to pursue these creative ways and innovative ways, which I think you commented. I posted something on social media. The Times ran a story on how during the Spanish flu of 1918, schools, many of them moved to outdoor classrooms.
Yeah, yeah.
And the journalist's point was, gee, why are we not on a war footing for this with education? Like, we really haven't come up with anything except to say you can sit seven kids in a room with your mask, or you can all go home and learn from your laptop.
Yeah.
But there's clearly some things in the middle of that, and it really doesn't seem that they're being pursued, I think. And I'm pretty dismayed by the lack of discussion around sort of these methods. But I think we're still in this sort of state of fear and paralysis.
Yeah.
And there's, and there's sort of a politics to all of it as well.
And just the fact that considering the fact that there's this many books on Amazon about pandemics,
right?
That we had no preparation in schools, in medicine, in our country in general, where places like Germany basically had a plan in place already. Like, they had, they had documented, and why are we not looking to what they're doing trying to figure that out?
As we
would with any history.
Yeah. That's right. And of course, a lot has to do with, I think, a unique American relationship between its people and its government. And so the German relationship to their government, I think, is different than the American And we don't have time for that long lecture, and there's a lot of other people more qualified to discuss it. But I think we are really seeing the impact of 20, 30 years of belittling experts, questioning facts and objectivity, shaping scientific narratives to political ends. This is like sort of this perfect storm. And I think you can see it in our, and you can see the result in the death count and the almost somewhat, pandemonium out there. I think every people who are really looking with their eyes open, Americans, I think have to be disturbed at what they're seeing. And knowing, I don't think, as you're pointing out, it didn't have to be this way. I mean, countries like Vietnam and Thailand actually are doing interesting things, that Vietnam claims to not have had a death. But New Zealand is not a richer country than America, but they've figured out how to really minimize COVID risk to a point where they're up and running right now.
Well, I think you're right this is about our relationship with government. And I think that's, when I talk to friends in Europe, I have a friend in Hong Kong, just sort of hearing the way, and Hong Kong has got its problems, but they've also kept the virus down, and part of it is there is a certain amount of compliance. They've also had more experience with, H1N1 and some other things in the last 10 years. So I think we've been lucky in the States to not, have to go through some of those other ones.
Yes.
But it's worked against us in this situation.
No question. America, geographically is situated in a place where it's just not as exposed to global pathogens and other things that can disrupt the society.
In terms of your teaching for the fall, do you have a certain amount of flexibility for the way that you can sort of do your teaching, or do they have some things that are sort of built in that you have to follow as far as curriculum is concerned? Because I feel like curriculum just got dropped at a certain point last spring.
That's an interesting question in that. So New York, I think, is somewhat unique. There's 100,000 teachers, and we're all, almost all of us, are part of a strong teaching union. And what that usually means is there's sort of uniform policies. Charter schools can circumvent sort of some of these policies. But it sort of means that within a classroom, Jeremy, yes, we can, 20 teachers can teach the Spanish flu and use a variety of methods to teach it. But as far as policies to like, hey, are we going to teach for 2 hours online or 5 hours in person? Those decisions are going to be made en masse for all these teachers. So from a labor perspective, that strength that you have, this sort of union, from a sort of flexibility perspective, there's some problems in that, you're not that nimble to sort of go around some of the rules. So, all this is being played out right now at a very high level between union leadership and the mayor and the Department of Education. So, for example, we were told to teach live, but students were told they didn't have to attend our live classes. This is my school specifically.
Yeah. What's your class size?
34 students to a class max, and almost every class I teach is 30 to 34, and New York City high school teacher teaches about 5 classes a day. So at those numbers, it's almost 170 students a day.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's pretty, there's not much hand-holding that can happen, even though students need that, so it's a challenge.
So how much of your day was one-on-one compared to the classes?
We had mandatory for teachers office hours every day.
Okay.
Of 1 hour in the afternoon. And most teachers, again, at least at my school, I think would say they were pretty disappointed in that very few students came to, quote unquote, visit us. Again, the medium of the Zoom meeting. So, for example, our school's policy was their cameras had to be turned off. Okay. So I could not see the faces of my students.
Oh, that's tough.
Very, yes. So, again, teaching's a very humanistic pursuit. And then all of a sudden you're told, you know, you're talking to faceless tiles. And the students who are, you know, at a time in their life where they're highly emotional and highly sensitive, all of a sudden are told, you know, that teacher you had a nice relationship with, you have to try to talk to them in this very strange, awkward, off-putting way.
Yeah.
And it just didn't work.
Yeah,
at least in remote education 1.0, and you can look across America at all the talk of this, it basically failed.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure you could ask any teacher, you know, what got them into teaching. I'm sure a lot of it is to, you know, there's a performative aspect of teaching where you love that engagement, just like a, you know, a stand-up comic would, of like, it's you and those faces, and being able to see the engagement with those faces is what you is you know, where you get your energy for the job.
No question. And I think most good teachers are really what I would call classroom teachers, that their energy is coming out of that classroom and that dynamic, that very human and social dynamic that includes a lot of laughter and a lot of just connecting over time to each other in a learning environment. There's an organic process to that that's very hard to replicate online. Not impossible. I think there are schools out there who are certainly more advanced in what is online education. And I think we need to be, I'm somewhat disappointed that, so now I've had like 6 months to start thinking about how to do this again in the fall. And there's been very little professional development or serious discussion about what makes a good, you know, an interactive online classroom.
Yeah.
Like Stanford University has an online high school that's considered one of the best in the country. They clearly know a few things. You know, we need to tap into that.
Yeah. Do you have any, was there anything that you learned from the spring that you feel like you, I mean, 170 students is a lot to address, but just in terms of being able to figure out ways of engagement. I mean, I think that's the tricky part, especially if you're just looking at tiles on a screen, to be able to think about. And like my daughter's going into a new school this year. She's not even going to, you know, meet the teacher. Yeah. So like, where do you start with that, that relationship?
I think what has to be figured out is how to get the group to engage with each other. So whether that's the chat room, like a blog that you create where students are talking to one another. Because let's not forget that a huge part of the learning process is also students to student interaction with a teacher, of course, leading and guiding this. But so again, recreating that digitally and remotely to me seems really a challenge. What I found is that students really like their, if they like their teachers, there's a lot of teachers they don't like.
Right.
They like the personality of their teacher. So I had to try to figure out how to replicate my personality, which, you know, includes certain types of jokes and some limited sarcasm, and how I would write a letter to my class to start the day every morning. Like, it took me months to sort of get my tone back in this new medium, or something close to a tone.
That's a muscle you got to, you know, work out for a little bit, it seems like.
Very much so, because early on, I was stiff.
Yeah.
You know? And even as I'm talking to you right now, this isn't my natural way of interacting with people. I sort of gesticulate a lot with my hands.
Yes, I know.
So, yeah, as you know. So it's a muscle that needs to be developed, and Jeremy, I'm looking at it like actually as a sort of a real learning moment for me. And I'm trying to be positive. Like, I've taught now 20 years. This is a new thing I need to get better at, and I need to figure out how to do that, because it's a reality. It's not going away.
Right.
COVID could end in 6 months. Online education in one form or another is here to stay.
Yeah. So that's the way I'm looking at this too. I feel like we're on a precipice here. You know, what does after this look like?
Yeah.
And you know, trying to pretend, I mean, I think there's a lot of people who have these sort of rosy predictions that are just getting, you know, demolished week after week. You know, they feel optimistic, and then they get shot down. And it's, I don't think that's a healthy way to continue to progress. I think we have to kind of look at, you know, what the you know, predictable reality is here. And I think the only thing we can say at this point is that just seeing what's happened in the last 6 months in the country, you know that it's going to be around for a while. So let's make the most of this situation, whether it's, you know, in our homes or with our friends or in our schools. I feel like that's kind of where we're at. I mean, I'm thinking about it in my practice too. You know, there are people who I'm not going to see for a long time. I've been coming to New York to treat people for a long time. And, you know, those are the people that, you know, who I'm starting to hear more and more from in text. You know, they're missing that our relationship was a lot about there's a closeness that develops. Some people I've treated for 20 years, you know, so I'm almost kind of like one of their family members. And
of course,
you know, I'm a touchstone for a lot of things as it relates to how they stress manage, and, you know, just a certain tone that I think I kind of bring to their lives just from being present at this point. You know, early on they came to me for something critical, but now we're just sort of there for tune-ups and check-ins. So
yes,
I think I'm even in the same boat as you. I'm trying to figure out how can I best keep those people on the same track. And I think I'm going to probably end up doing it more through writing and maybe even doing some video, which is not my comfort zone, but, you know, just so that they have some, you know, little piece. It's going to take more work for me. It's something I'm not accustomed to doing. I mean, starting the podcast, at least I got used to writing for voiceover type stuff, but, you know, this is a little bit different. And
yes,
Luckily I have the podcast where, you know, I know that some of them are just checking in, listening to me just to sort of hear my voice, you know, but I think most people have to really kind of come up with just some, you know, something that they can make peace with for now, given the situation.
That's right. Maybe what I can relate to that is, I didn't tell you why we left Hawaii, but after 2 years there, and we were all very content, I have a 79-year-old father who, over the last 5 years, he's been diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS. And I have my in-laws in Connecticut, luckily very healthy, but in their 70s. And we decided, you know, being 7,000 miles away from family members, especially one who is facing real health challenges, my father, and the joy they receive from seeing their grandchildren, as well as their own children,
we decided,
you know, I wasn't sleeping that well at night in Hawaii after 2 years being that far away from a father with a health issue. So we moved back. And of course, the sort of sad irony is I moved back to be closer to my father, and now visiting my father is very fraught with risk and danger. But I have made the decision to the best of my ability to sort of try to stay safe. And I have visited him 3 times since this has begun, including with my children. And then, but again, each family manages these decisions differently.
Going forward with this fall teaching.
Yeah.
Are you kind of waiting to get some word now? I mean, as far as, because you guys don't start till late September, right?
We actually start after Labor Day traditionally,
do?
Which is early September. And right now the start date has not been announced, but we are operating under the assumption that there would be sometime in September, but I guess it could be pushed to the end We're, again, I think there are many teachers nervous about going back into a classroom. If I'm being honest, I think I'm in somewhat in a minority that I am okay with going back in what I hope will be a safe way. To me, it's the risk is worth seeing my students, even in this pretty limited capacity. Yeah. You know, teachers, I think it's hard for us as teachers to say, well, we're essential workers. All those other essential workers who are out there driving subways, buses, supermarkets, that they should come in, but we shouldn't. Again, it's very, I'm not speaking for all teachers here, just myself. Cause most of my colleagues do not want to go back, actually, yeah. If I could generalize. Yeah.
And you know, it's a moment, I've been thinking about it a lot too, where we are, you know, calling one thing essential, you know, yeah. it's sort of hard to define yeah. what that is at yeah. this point.
Yeah.
I was starting to think, you know, it's not worth it for me, the same kind of thing, like to you know, I treat people one-on-one, hands-on work. You know, yeah. there's some risk there for sure, but you know, how essential is that for certain people? I have some people who live with, you know, high levels of anxiety or, you know, manage chronic pain or things like that, that, you know, to them, there is a point at which if they don't get the support, and what I provide can kind of only happen in person, then they're missing something essential for themselves. So I've kind of realized I'm going to, you know, try to look at this situation and do everything I can to you know, get myself to be available, because and you know, I may end up with some sort of distance ways of doing this. I've already kind of figured out ways to do, because I teach movement work as well. I kind of,
right.
you know, what I do is almost kind of a physical therapy, you know, combination of different things with some osteopathic work. So if I can provide certain things from afar, and you know, sometimes my voice and presence is enough for them on a screen. Sometimes yeah. it's clearly not, you know, and I'm going to try to, like, you know, adapt to this situation as much as possible. And, you know, I've just like you, I feel like I have to kind of think about this in a way where I'm hoping that I can learn something from this, that this is an opportunity as well.
Yes. I've been trying to, you know, apply that approach, but So, for example, I decided as a 50-year-old man, I should really start paying more attention to my health, as I've always been a reluctant
In what way?
Advocate. So I was, right before the pandemic, I was pretty regular at my local Y doing exercise, as well as starting yoga for the first time in my life with an instructor and one other friend of mine, sort of almost semi-private life.
Yeah, yeah.
And interestingly enough, when the pandemic hit and she moved her yoga class to Zoom, I actually have not been on one single class since then, knowing I really should, because there was some momentum and I know I'll get something out of it, but I've not yet. I just, you know, you teach history, you realize people cling to the past, they cling to their regular structures. It's very hard to make these changes, yet change comes and you're caught flat-footed. And I need to also to sort of become a little more adept at moving and changing. So,
yeah,
that, you know, that's my own take. So I'm trying not to just complain and say, I can't teach on Zoom. I just need to, like you just said, sort of figure out how to meet this challenge and, you know, I do believe in the so-called growth mindset, and I think there are all these new things one can learn, and right now is an opportunity to do this. So.
Yeah, and there's probably going to be a part of what we do, because on some level, I feel like I'm an educator,
yeah.
and I know that there's some stuff that's being missed during this time, but I think there's a part of us where, you know, we kind of had a captive audience when we could be with people. And so now we really are going to have to go through a learning process of how do we engage and you know, get people excited about doing this for themselves in the same way that, you know that these yoga classes would be helpful for you.
Yeah.
But, you know, and part of it is that I think we're all so overwhelmed. It's exhausting. I mean, there are times when you just really can't get your, you know, because you're processing so much different information, you can't keep your head in the right space at times. You know, you and I share a good friend and we text all the time. And you know, one of the things he's asking me all the time is like, you know, are you getting anything done?
Right.
You know, I feel like we're all just kind of in a spin right now. And I'm kind of hoping that, you know, and some of it is the summer, you know, and
yeah,
you know, it is that time where there are parts of me that feel like I really should just, you know, let down right now and just enjoy this a little bit too. And I have my moments for sure. You know, if I take my daughter, you know, to the lake to swim or do something like that, I can really get into that moment. But like the minute that we're out of that, you know, I'm back in my head again, kind of going through all this stuff. So I think some structure, you know, is going to be helpful. And I think school is going to, you know, provide that. And I think maybe that's the most important thing that, you know, maybe teachers and educators in general can kind of focus on right now, is just like really engaging that structure.
Yes. I mean, students really like knowing what, maybe most people do. I actually feel like I'm slightly an atypical teacher in that I like, still, a lot of teachers I work with, not that they do the same thing over and over again, but they really like knowing 2 weeks in advance exactly what they're doing.
Yeah.
And I certainly riff a lot more and get a lot out of that. And I think my students get my style and I think it works.
Yeah.
At least that's what I tell myself. But so, yes, getting back some of that structure, which was really lost, and that's how we lost students. But again, you know, I was thinking about what I just told you about the yoga teacher. I realized the reason I kept going back is that I really liked her as a teacher. She was really good. And I thought, how good can it be when I just see her online? It's not going to be the same. Yeah. So I'm not. But I need to overcome that.
Well, I'm even just thinking, like, as we're talking, knowing how you like to riff, like there, and I, you know, I got involved in doing a podcast just because of the way that I was using them, and realizing that, you know, it's one of those things that's sometimes it occupies a separate space in the way that people used to just have a radio on in the background and,
you know,
listen to NPR or, you know, some talk news or whatever. There's a piece of that I think can be, you know, and I know people who have desk jobs who basically just always have, you know, some kind of thing on in the background because they can multitask, you know, to some extent with these kinds of things, or when you're exercising or whatever. And there may be some ways to start using, you know, technology for these kinds of things where maybe, you know, let me know. I'll help you. I'll help you put together something for your classes or something. If you have a topic
you up on that
you might want to, you know, present and have it be fun. Like it's not that hard to engage, but I think we have to come up with some ideas like that. And I'm not a person who's been comfortable on video, but I'm realizing that I think this year I'm going to have to sort of step into that a little bit because of having an audience, but also because I know a lot of people who, and just because I'm sort of, you know, in the mix with so many different kinds of therapies, where I hear things and I think of solutions, and I think, you know, there's this very, you know, specific thing that can be sort of taken, broken down simply for people, and there are people who are really trying to get this information, and that's kind of the way I've thought about, you know, the podcast is just distilling some of this. I think there are some people who listen to this who are in health fields, and there are some people who are, you know, they just kind of stay tuned into to things like this because they're looking for solutions too. And I think that this, you know, the same thing could happen in education. I'm kind of you know, I think there could be something in terms of entertainment. I mean, which is what I think it almost kind of has to be at this point. Where
well, you
know, really
a good
engage.
Teacher does some entertaining, that's for sure.
Right.
And, you know, speaking of podcasting, that's something actually for years now I've been thinking I really need to get my students maybe doing. And the private school I taught at in Hawaii, there were teachers having their students podcast.
Oh, that would be cool.
This
would
really
be a really
cool.
Great time for that, too. You can do it pretty simply. So
yes.
I'll just put it out there right now. Anybody who's interested, hit me up. I can give you some real simple basics to make it happen without too much cost.
Well, I'm going to hit you up on that.
All right, cool, man. Yeah. Well, hey, thanks so much for doing this, Serge. It's great to talk to you, and I miss you. And
I miss you, too.
Hopefully we can do this in person again at some point.
Yes, 6 feet apart, beer in hand.
That's right.
And I would like to hopefully see you soon. But Jeremy, it was a nice time.
Likewise. Serge Avery, folks. Always so great talking to him. What is essential, one of the things that came up here in this conversation, is something that I think is pretty important for us to sit with right now. And I believe we can be much smarter about managing the risks with COVID if we have a better understanding of what we truly need, both personally and collectively. And what is essential, I think, will just inevitably surface. And what I'm feeling personally, what I find myself craving, is this regular physical presence of those people that I was so accustomed to spending time with. You know, hugging when we meet, sitting elbow to elbow at a conference, deep in conversation next to one another on bar stools. Proximity to one another, as science has shown in so many studies, is what really breathes life into us. It calms our nervous systems, it improves our moods, it floods our brains with neurochemicals and allows us to feel all those good feelings. And history tells us that, you know, on the other side of these moments of loss are opportunities to improve. I believe that we were getting off track before quarantine with something that was probably essential to our nature. And if we're going to improve as a culture, we need to have what's essential be the building blocks of what we become together as a society on the other side of this. Let me know what you thought of this topic and conversation. You can always reach me at jeremy@highway2.health. And if you found anything important or timely here, don't forget to share it with anyone else who you think would appreciate it. Thanks for listening and for all that you do. Be good to yourself, be kind to each other, and take care of your planet. Be well, my friends.